Thank you very much for Print for hosting what me for me is a momentous occasion. This, I think, my first attempt to do a podcast, hosting a podcast, and that one with Amartya Sen, who, of course, needs no introduction, in the context of his, I think, wonderful memoir, The Home in the World, published by Alan Lane. So thank you very much for agreeing to do this.
I'm
really honored and very grateful. I think in some ways, what your book does, which I really cherish, and it's a memoir. You've had a fascinating life, but it's a memoir. It's an intellectual memoir. It's an intellectual memoir in a sense that's rare in Bangla, at least in our. So, and therefore rare in the culture of talking about Kolkata and the intellectual climate around Kolkata. It's a book that does talk about your life and in important ways makes your life come alive, but it's very much about a set of intellectual moments. And I want to focus on that because in some ways that to me is the most exciting part of the book. So I'm going to try to, maybe I'm misreading it, but the things in the book that really I found striking, and I'll start with one of them. So I think the sense of reading the first chapters of the book is when you were young, in your last years in Shantiniketan and when you came to Kolkata, there seems to be an extraordinary intellectual effulgence that you encounter. And you become, of course, a part of it, even a star of it. But that effulgence, that sort of flowering of ideas, that excitement about ideas, that climate of being, you know, somehow discovering just new ways of looking at the world and in the arts, in literature, in economics, in science, and in mathematics, in statistics, all of those things seem to be happening at the same time. So first, is it that, am I misreading? Do you want us to think of this as being a special moment? And then if that's the case, what do you think made it happen at that time? What were the sources of that that moment, if you like?
Yeah. Now, I, of course, the book is a memoir only of the first 30 years or so of my life. So it's really the early days. And the moment that you're describing is about halfway down there. That is, I have spent my childhood in Burma, in Mandalay, and in Dhaka, what is now Bangladesh, and then Shantiniketan, which I enormously enjoyed, this school established by Tagore. And I was a sense of freedom, which was fantastic. And I think what happened when I moved from Shantiniketan to Calcutta, to Presidency College, was quite related to the experiences I have had in Shantiniketan. Shantiniketan, I felt quite free to do what I wanted to do. The open health library, I spent hours, seems like days there, and I was studying things which had got almost nothing to do sometimes with my curriculum. But then I moved to Presidency College to do economics and mathematics. And that was an exciting moment, both because the college was exciting, Presidency College, and also because the company was so, and also the opportunity to talk with really exciting people across the street in the coffee house where we often gathered was quite a remarkable experience for me. Yes, I was excited, and I thought I did have reason to be excited.
But what is it that moment, why do you think that, I mean, partly you're saying I was prepared for excitement, but then was it really exciting? Was it that there was, in the sense that, was there an intellectual climate that even other than the fact that you were hungry for knowledge and you came from a particular background, you spent your time in the library stacks, so you were obviously someone with the right preparation. But is there something more about that moment that
Yeah, I think it's quite a bit more. I think there are really exciting classmates whom I enjoyed talking with very much, including Sukumar Chakravarti, fellow economist, Patsho Gupta, who is a historian, Nikhilesh Vattacharya, a statistic, and really exciting people. And I often had concerns and questions that I felt I could chat about with others. And that certainly gave me an opportunity in the college to do that. But across the street, there was the, as I mentioned, the coffee house. And the coffee house was a great place for what Bengalis would call Adda, namely a kind of agenda-less discussion. And coffee house was a fairly astonishingly interesting place where I spent often half my day rather than in classes. And it was very good to talk about politics and the history, culture, and so on. And I was getting absorbed in what I would say the Calcutta culture of that period, which included politics, but also included theater, plays, films. We were getting Italian neorealist films coming, like Bicycle Thief and Vessel of Milan and so on. So there were lots of really new and exciting things going on, which I could on one side dip into and on the other side chat about with my classmates. And often we agreed, often we disagreed. In politics, that's easy to do and that's fun doing. So I didn't know how much of an opportunity of that I would have once I come to Calcutta. But it turned out to be just what I could have at best wanted. And staying in the YMCA hostel, not far from there, about 20, 25 minutes walk. And all kinds of people from different colleges, medical college, science college, and so on, there. And it was a very exciting time for me.
Let me push that a little. Maybe two things. One is, who were your interlocutors? Who were you talking to? You named some, but those were your close friends. Were there other people a bit beyond in theater, as you say? In who were the conversations with? I mean, in the more expanded circles of that. I assume you also encountered in coffee house. I know coffee house culture.
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of people who with whom I disagreed. Like one of them, which mentioned, say, Anand Bhatto, who is unlike me. His politics more was much more right wing than mine. There were also quite strongly left wing people like Shifra Sarkar, with whom I could disagree or agree. And I think they were exciting to me that whether it was agreement or disagreement, there was much to discuss. And I admired what was going on, the new boom in Bengali theater was exciting to me. I didn't know the Shambhu Mitra, Tripti Mitra, and others personally, but I admired their work and I went to see them. And I occasionally even talked with them when I had an opportunity. And I was also concerned the change of politics that's taking place in India. at large, India became independent in 47. By 50, 51, it had a new constitution, a democratic constitution. That was offering an enormous opportunity of political disagreement and political rejuvenation, indeed. And this was after waiting for independence for decades and fighting for it. When I was a child, most of my uncles, occasionally even aunts, were in prison. They were what the British called preventive detention. Not that they had done anything wrong, but they were in prison on grounds that they could, and if they were left free. So there were these imprisoned uncles and cousins of mine, and I knew about them, I knew about their dream. And then suddenly the dream seemed possible, and Calcutta was a very good place for that. It had also the exciting fact that there had been a partition and East Pakistan was mostly based on Muslim League, where the West Bengal was more Congress-oriented. But along with the Hindu-Muslim question came the language question, and the partition took place in 47, but by 52, there were major revolts going on in what will become Bangladesh later than East Pakistan in the colleges. The issue of Hindu-Muslim difference seemed to have suddenly disappeared, and instead there was a question about whether we can demand Bengali to be a major language, and indeed one of the two major languages of Pakistan along with Urdu. So all kinds of new issues coming up. And for me, the fact that the Hindu-Muslim hostility had been replaced by a much more constructive question about the place of language in human society, that for me was exciting also, especially since I came from Dhaka, and it's in Dhaka that these things were happening mostly. There were ripples of that in Calcutta too. But altogether, taking India, Pakistan together, it was a time of excitement.
So it was a time of excitement. And I think you're saying, I did try to press you to say, but I think you are saying, but yeah. Maybe I just want to be sure. You're saying it's not that it was you. It was there was a climate of excitement all around. Everybody else was excited too, and they were excited and therefore exciting. Is that an exaggeration?
Yeah, everybody else would be an exaggeration.
Sure,
they were
some were boring people always.
Boring, I don't know, but there were some real scholars who spent their time in the National Library and went back to practice and so on, which I like doing from time to time. But I was interested also in politics, and there were lots of people in politics taking very different points of view, and I enjoyed that. And did I feel involved and committed to joining that? Yes. Was I absolutely certain which side I was on? That would be hard to say. It was clear to me that any kind of politics which did not give a primary role to poor people and people who had a really difficult life, whether as workers or as poor peasants or sharecroppers or rural laborers. I thought that priority was important. But then there were other questions, namely, how should they be led? Would that be regime that's concerned with discipline primarily, rather than being compositional interaction with each other? And these are important questions. I had encountered them, I will encounter them later on in the context of European differences, like in Italy, let's say, Gramsci and the left-wing movement in Italy, or in England. But in Calcutta, I was in the middle of that already, having just finished school in Shantiniketan and having arrived at a college which was almost 200 years old and which really had quite a history. Basically, it's a college, it's a rather remarkable college originally set up not by the government, but by the civil society, and having a very wide variety of intellectual background behind it. All that was for a young man, a young boy coming from Shantiniketan, really exciting for me.
So I think you're already starting to allude to something you wanted to pursue. So if this was an exciting time, would you say that what comes after this is something of a, maybe what follows is a period that's maybe less exciting, and there is a sense of maybe, if not decay, of a certain stasis intellectually? That's question number one. And if you agree with that, that seems to be implied in your book. So I'm going to, that's why I'm pursuing the next question. Does it have anything to do with the other thing you alluded to, which is the question of leadership? Of, is it the case that because a lot of the leading lights of this moment were on the left, and there was a sense that maybe the left needs to fall in line and not be too discursive, is there a sense in which that had something to do with the next phase of intellectual, the way the intellectual culture went? Is it the case that there was something that was connected to this sense of, you know, urgency that, you know, the revolution is around the corner, and we need to just, you know, whatever, shoulder arms and not argue too much? Is there something like that that comes? And that seems to be also a feeling I get in your book, but I think you
get it rightly. I think what's happening is there are different types of diagnosis about where we are at that time. There are indeed some who were quite convinced that the revolution, as you put it, is around the corner. And yet many others feel that that the revolution requires much more preparation. I think there was also a major distinction that was being made. For example, throughout the time of fight for India's independence, there were questions about nonviolence. The Gandhiji, and to some extent Rabindranath, were entirely convinced about that being the only way. And yet there were people, including great leaders like Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose, who wouldn't regard that to be the best way of understanding the degree. But along with that came the left tradition, which was not anti-nonviolent, but which was much more concerned with mass movement. And I think, oddly enough, the best interpreter of that was probably Rabindranath Tagore in Bharatai, Dr. Corby, and other places, where he makes a sharp distinction between people who seem to be looking for a violent way forward, but in fact, as they think more deeply, it becomes clear even to them that what is needed is not a violent way forward, but a mass organized way, putting your hand on the hands of others together, going forward in that form. So that was a big issue. I think Dr. Corby and Chalotai, among the major plays that were written, I think. And these were, oddly enough, written by someone who was totally committed to nonviolence, but who also thought that to the extent that there is a case for rejecting it, the rejection shouldn't take the form of regarding violence to be important, but organized mass movement. And that became one of the major things to be discussed. And I think it was right to say that when ultimately the left came to office in West Bengal, their achievements connected with land reform, connected with village rural self-government, these were features in which the mass movement was very central. And those who would look back now to that period and say, what is it that's lost? I think it would appear to many, I think it would appear to me also, even though we're very far away from those days, that the mass movement aspect had gone quite a bit back to be replaced by a movement that had more presence of violence in it. It's a subject we can discuss.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, maybe, but that dispute, in a sense, also plays out inside the intellectual culture. There's the, you know, there's a little p politics of all academic cultures where people are jealous of each other or they want to advance. But there's also the big p politics of that. And it's very important, it seems to me, in your book and from everything else I've read. This is a period, say, the 50s and 60s and 70s are all periods where the political stance you take is a very important part of the evaluation of your academic work. And I know, interestingly, now at this point, I would say you are a clear hero for the left. But I remember times, and I'm substantially younger than you. I remember times when I think this was less clear, that there were lots of attacks on you from the left as well. And this ambivalence maybe that you're expressing through the mention of Tagore and Tagore's ambivalence about the use of violence in social movements, and is also maybe it was, I don't know if it was your ambivalence or your willingness to discuss it. What provoked that? I mean, you've always been committed to the ideals of equality, of removing poverty, of fighting for the rights of the poor, and maybe more than most, almost any economists have spent your life doing that. So how did it come to be that you were, at some ways, times, you know, left was quite suspicious of you? How did that come about?
Yes, I think that good reason to be suspicious. Namely, there was, I think that these are issues that go back in the history of the world, elsewhere also. One of the debates that who will become my teacher in Cambridge, Piero Sraffa, a leading left-wing thinker, say Marxist in many ways. One of the differences he had with the communist movement, strongly, and Gramsci, the leader of it in particular, was the issue of liberty. And Sraffa was convinced that liberty is something which the general public needs more than almost anything else. He said so. He argues with it. The left doesn't like paying up these debates, and therefore we should talk with Italian left-wing leaders or Communist Party. They're nearly gone now. But when they were active, they didn't like to play the difference between Sraffa and Gramsci. But the fact is, Sraffa was saying liberty was very important. I didn't know Sraffa's writing at that time. But I felt that very strongly. And to some extent, that came to me from elsewhere, and you may even say in the context of left-wing hierarchy, also from sources that were heterogeneous and desperate, like John Stuart Mill, like T.H. Green, who were people that I was learning things from. And I did think that liberty was extraordinarily important. And I wouldn't let it go there. Similarly, I did think that there was very little that can take the place of democratic elections and so on. And I won't let go of that either, even though quite often the left used to describe it as bourgeois democracy. And
I remember those words.
And liberty being something which is a kind of thing that very rich people are worried about, but not the hungry, illiterate, and the very poor. I thought both of these were mistakes. Now, I was in an art tradition because in Residency College, Calcutta, I became, not because so much that I worked for it, but I somehow had a leadership position of the left movement, what was called the Student Federation.
Mm-hmm.
The Student Federation was an offshoot of the Communist Party, with which I had fundamental disagreement. But somehow, the Student Federation was ready to accept me as their leader. In fact, I'm right in thinking that the first time that the Student Federation had a victory, not a full victory, we got three of the major seats in the student election, including general secretary. And that was done when I was leading the Student Federation. And yet they would always say that they liked me and liked my leadership. On the other hand, they thought I was wrong about liberty, about bourgeois democracy. And
it was nice of them that they at least had you as a leader. I mean, that in a sense is, maybe that was a moment, or it was you. But I think that part of, I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that those simmering divides within the left have something to do with the intellectual landscape becomes maybe less exciting afterwards? Do you think that that has something to do with
it? Well, it may, but I think it also has a lot to do with the international concern that the Indian politics increasingly continue to have, and that included fighting for your rights, like in Vietnam. That included, in a very odd way, even the movement in Cuba. But Cuba wasn't a non-violent movement, it was violent. On the other hand, the main leadership was a question of what Tagore had seen as mass movement. So I think I was playing the role of being the mass movement champion. And that was, if there was one line I could put my faith in. And I did give several, well, Residency College here used to have debates again and again. My debates often took the form of championing mass movement and why that was really, very important. And I often quoted Tagore. That again itself was a problem, because quite often the left regarded Tagore to be, after all, a bourgeois, maybe even worse, maybe bourgeois thinker. And so there was a problem, but it happened. It wasn't an equilibrium. I went away to England, and so that was. But we didn't come to the debate, but I still remember one of the occasions just before I was going off taking my boat to England. One of the student federation leaders coming to see me, and he said, "So, what's going to happen in the election next year?" I said, "That's your problem. I'm going elsewhere." So it was an uneasy equilibrium. But I survived in it. I enjoyed that. And I think if I may be somewhat proud of something that I did make my point about the importance of liberty and the importance of democratic election. Soon, there was no problem. In about 20 years after that, the Communist Party was quite concerned with liberty and with the election.
But there's a period in between. So this issue of the left and its discomfort on these kinds of, you know, the questions of that sort of, I would say, British, you know, Anglo-Saxon liberal traditions and their connections to the ideals of the left. And this is something that, in a sense, continues in your life, because the next phase in your life is you're in Cambridge. And in Cambridge, at this point, this is the bastion of left-wing economics. And if I may say so, what happens later is left-wing economics as kind of a specific sub-discipline of economics dies or almost disappears. So is there a connection between this ambivalence and maybe intolerance coming out of an impatience with, you know, nuances and, you know, this is the time to take sides, this kind of view. I know that you, for example, in your book, you write very fondly about Dennis Robertson, who was not of the left. And then I know that Peter Bauer, who was not of the left. And later you had a long association with Bob Nozick, who's not of the left. So you always kept doors open. And is that something that you think was a problem for the left? This is the last question I'm going to ask. I know it's too big a question, but I still wanted to ask it because it's so interesting. And you had a ringside view of all these things.
Yeah, they were very exciting people for me. And I wasn't cultivating them as non-left, right-wing, anything like that. Dennis Robertson, who was in my college, I arrived and I could see him in my first week. And I had a fantastically good talk with him. And Peter Bauer hauls me out of one of his early classes. And he said, look, we ought to argue about that. So why don't we have coffee together? And I was very flattered that even as a first-year student, I was having coffee with this extraordinarily good teacher almost once a week. I, and Nozick, as far as the same, I found them to be telling me something which are really important, which I think Peter Bauer was the finest in the economics that England had at that time. He happened to be right wing. And I felt devoted to them because of their intellectual brilliance and what they stood for. I was also able to do that because one of the results of being rather devoted to liberty is that I could leave the matter to Dennis Robertson and Peter Bauer and Nozick to judge how they would do and for me to decide whether there is something I would like to have in it. When I first arrived, I was very active in what was called the Socialist Club, not to be confused with the Labour Club. The Labour Club was very much a Labour Party oriented thing. Socialist Club was much more to the left. But one of the rules that the Labour Club had is that you cannot join the Labour Club if you're a member of the Socialist Club, because they were afraid of there being infiltration by the communists into that. I found that so impossible that I immediately made a statement saying I absolutely would not think about joining the Labour Club. And that remained true until, of course, Labour Club became much more left-wing in many ways than any other club. So things were going through turmoil. I enjoyed, I have to say, the turmoil, but I particularly enjoyed when there were disagreement and when I had something to learn from others. And quite often there were many old things, like Sam Britton, a great financial journalist, came to see me saying, I plan to come to convert you to the Labour Club. But unfortunately, I went to Soviet Union during the summer, and I got so revolted that I've decided to resign from the Labour Club, and I wanted to join the Liberal Club. I said, well, neither of them is going to happen, but explain to me, what is it that you found so revolting? And I really learned something from that. So I would say you're right in thinking that there were important issues I was trying to resolve. I never quite equilibrated, and I think that lack of equilibrium was a matter of quite great importance to me.
That's a wonderful line to let you end on, but I want to ask you one last thing, which is, do you think that has the fact that you were willing to tolerate the disequilibrium, is that something that you think has something to do with why much of the left in economics imploded? That they were looking for too much equilibrium, or that they wanted too easy resolutions? What do you think? I mean, I just want your quick diagnosis of what happened to the left in economics. Why is there's really used to be a field of left-wing economics. It doesn't really exist in the mainstream anymore.
No, and mainly because it's like the Bengali expression that you hit your foot with the spade. I think the fact is that some people felt totally committed to wanting to pursue a predefined line. And I think it's not even the Marxists who did it most. I think I would say they, for a while, it was the neo-Keynesians who would not accept anything at all. I remember trying to publish something in the Cambridge Journal of Economics, which was the way in neo-Keynesian, and they wouldn't take it. After a little while, they wanted me to be a patron of their journal. because, you know, I think I was an ancient and respectable and so on. But if I think of those, and I emphasize they were physically often not much. There were people like Eric Hobsbawm, other people like Theodore Sapa, and for that matter, Maurice Dawe, who could take a lot of disagreement, and yet...
These were the Marxists who could take the disagreement, you know.
These are the Marxists, that's right. And there were much more hostility to the quote-unquote enemy on the part of the neo-Keynesian, and they really wanted to. It's not true quite of Keynes, if you think about the... many of them, I think, not at all, but it is, it went in that direction. So I think, yes, you would be at least partly right in thinking that the demise of the left has partly to do with it in total. And that's true of the world climate in general. You don't have to look at Russia and Ukraine to recognize how sharpened the differences have often become. It's probably a little unfair because Putin is not a slave finger. But this is exciting stuff, what you're asking me.
I'm super excited. Thank you. That was amazing. And thank you very much.
Thank you.